"Won't do, won't do," said the tall one. "We encourage our employees to obtain mortgages."
"He's working on it," Zizmo said. Meanwhile, the short one had entered the kitchen. He was lifting lids off pots, opening the oven door, peering into the garbage can. Desdemona started to object, but Lena checked her with a glance. And notice how Desdemona's nose has begun to twitch. For 2 days now, her sense of smell has been incredibly acute. Foods are beginning to smell funny to her. Feta cheese like dirty socks, olives like goat droppings.
"How often do you bathe, Mr. Stephanides?" the tall one asked.
"Every day, sir."
"How often do you brush your teeth?"
"Every day, sir."
"What do you use?"
"Baking soda." Now the short one was climbing the stairs. He invaded my grandparents' bedroom and inspected the linens. He stepped into the bathroom and examined the toilet seat.
"From now on, use this," the tall one said. "It's a dentifrice. Here's a new toothbrush."
Disconcerted, my grandfather took the items. "We come from Bursa," he explained. "It's a big city."
"Brush along the gum lines. Up on the bottoms and down on the tops. 2 minutes, morning and night. Let's see. Give it a try."
"We are civilized people.
Do I understand you to be refusing hygiene instruction?"
"Listen to me," Zizmo said. "The Greeks built the Parthenon and the Egyptians built the pyramids back when the Anglo-Saxons were still dressing in animal skins."
The tall one took a long look at Zizmo and made a note on his pad. "Like this?" my grandfather said, grinning hideously. He moved the toothbrush up and down in his dry mouth.
"That's right. Fine."
The short one now reappeared from upstairs. He flipped open his pad and began. "Item 1, garbage can in kitchen has no lid. Item 2, housefly on kitchen table. Item 3, too much garlic in food causes indigestion." And now Desdemona locates the culprit, the short man's hair. The smell of brilliantine on it makes her nauseous.
"Very considerate of you to come here and take an interest in your employee's health," Zizmo said. "We wouldn't want anybody to get sick now, would we? Might slow down production."
"I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that," said the tall one, "seeing as you are not an official employee of the Ford Motor Company. However," turning back to my grandfather, "I should advise you, Mr. Stephanides, that in my report, I'm going to make a note of your social relations. I'm going to recommend that you and Mrs. Stephanides move into your own home as soon as it is financially feasible."
"And may I ask what your occupation is, sir?"
the short one wanted to know.
"I'm in shipping," Zizmo said.
"Nice of you gentlemen to stop by," Lena moved in. "But if you'll excuse us, we're just about to have dinner. We have to go to church tonight, and of course Lefty has to be in bed by 9 to get rest. He likes to be fresh in the morning."
"Oh, that's fine. Fine."
Together, they put on their hats and left. And so we come to the weeks leading up to the graduation pageant. To Desdemona, sewing a Palacari vest, embroidering it with red, white, and blue thread. To Lefty, getting off work one Friday evening and crossing over Miller Road to be paid from the armored truck. To Lefty again, the night of the pageant, taking the streetcar to Cadillac Square and walking into Gold's Clothes. Jimmy Zizmo meets him there to help him pick out a suit.
"It's almost summer. How about something cream-colored with a yellow silk necktie?"
"No, the English teacher told us blue or gray only."
"They want to turn you into a Protestant. Resist."
"I'll take the blue suit, please, thank you," Lefty says in his best English. And here, too, the shop owner seems to owe Zizmo a favor. He gives them a 20% discount. Meanwhile, on Hurlbut, Father Stylianopoulos, head priest of Assumption Greek Orthodox Church, has finally come over to bless the house. Desdemona watches the priest nervously as he drinks the glass of metaxa she has offered him. When she and Lefty became members of his congregation, the old priest had asked, as a formality, if they had received an Orthodox wedding. Desdemona had replied in the affirmative. She had grown up believing that priests could tell whether someone was telling the truth or not, but Father Stylianopoulos had only nodded and written their names into the church register. Now he sets down his glass. He stands and recites the blessing, shaking holy water on the threshold. Before he's finished, however, Desdemona's nose begins acting up again. She can smell what the priest had for lunch. She can detect the aroma under his arms as he makes the sign of the cross. At the door, letting him out, she holds her breath.
Thank you, Father, thank you.
Stylianopoulos goes on his way, but it's no use. As soon as she inhales again, she can smell the fertilized flower beds and Mrs. Seslowski boiling cabbage next door. And what she swears must be an open jar of mustard somewhere. All these scents gone wayward on her. As she puts a hand to her stomach, right then the bedroom door swings open. Sormelina steps out. Powder and rouge cover one side of her face. The other side, bare, looks green.
Do you smell something? She asks.
Yes, I smell everything.
Oh, my God.
What is it?
I didn't think this would happen to me. To you, maybe, but not to me.
And now we are in the Detroit Light Guard Armory later that night, 7 p.m. An assembled audience of 2,000 settles down as the house lights dim. Prominent business leaders greet each other with handshakes. Jimmy Zizmo, in a new cream-colored suit with yellow necktie, crosses his legs, jiggling one saddle shoe. Lena and Desdemona hold hands, joined in a mysterious union. The curtain parts to gasps and scattered applause. A painted flat shows a steamship, two huge smokestacks, and a swath of deck and railing. A gangway extends into the stage's other focal point, a giant gray cauldron emblazoned with the words, Ford English School Melting Pot. A European folk melody begins to play. Suddenly, a lone figure appears on the gangway, dressed in a Balkan costume of vest, ballooning trousers, and high leather boots. The immigrant carries his possessions bundled on a stick. He looks around with apprehension and then descends into the melting pot.
What propaganda, Zizmo murmurs in his seat. Lena shushes him.
Now Syria descends into the pot, then Italy, Poland, Norway, Palestine, and finally Greece.
Look, it's Lefty.
Wearing embroidered palacari vest, puffy sleeve pucamiso, and pleated fustanella skirt, my grandfather bestrides the gangway. He pauses a moment to look out at the audience, but the bright lights blind him. He can't see my grandmother looking back, bursting with her secret. Germany taps him on the back.
Mach schnell! Excuse me. Go fastly!
In the front row, Henry Ford nods with approval, enjoying the show. Mrs. Ford tries to whisper in his ear, but he waves her off. His blue seagull's eyes dart from face to face as the English instructors appear on stage next. They carry long spoons, which they insert into the pot. The lights turn red and flicker as the instructors stir. Steam rises over the stage. Inside the cauldron, men are packed together, throwing off immigrant costumes, putting on suits. Limbs are tangling up, feet stepping on feet. Lefty says, oh, pardon me, excuse me, feeling thoroughly American as he pulls on his blue wool trousers and jacket. In his mouth, 32 teeth brushed in the American manner, his underarms liberally sprinkled with American deodorant. And now, spoons are descending from above. Men are churning around and around. As two men, short and tall, stand in the wings, holding a piece of paper. And out in the audience, my grandmother has a stunned look on her face. And the melting pot boils over. Red lights brighten. The orchestra launches into Yankee Doodle. One by one, the Ford English School graduates rise from the cauldron. Dressed in blue and gray suits, they climb out, waving American flags to thunderous applause. The curtain had barely come down before the men from the sociological department approached. I passed the final exam, my grandfather told them. 93%, and today I open savings account.
That sounds fine, the tall one said, but unfortunately it's too late.
said the short one. He took a slip from his pocket, a color well known in Detroit, pink.
We did some checking on your landlord, the so-called Jimmy Zizmo. He's got a police record.
I don't know anything, my grandfather said. I'm sure it's a mistake. He's a nice man, works hard.
I'm sorry, Mr. Stephanides, but you can understand that Mr. Ford can't have workers maintaining such associations. You don't need to come down to the plant on Monday.
As my grandfather struggled to absorb this news, the short one leaned in.
I hope you learn a lesson from this. Mixing with the wrong crowd can sink you. You seem like a nice guy, Mr. Stephanides. You really do. We wish you the best of luck in the future.
A few minutes later, Lefty came out to meet his wife. He was surprised when, in front of everyone, she hugged him, refusing to let go. You like the pageant? It's not that. What is it? Desdemona looked into her husband's eyes. But it was Sormelina who explained it all. Your wife and I, she said in plain English, we're both knocked up. Minotaurs. Which is something I'll never have much to do with, like most hermaphrodites, but by no means all. I can't have children. That's one of the reasons why I've never married. It's one of the reasons, aside from shame, why I decided to join the Foreign Service. I've never wanted to stay in one place. After I started living as a male, my mother and I moved away from Michigan, and I've been moving ever since. In another year or two, I'll leave Berlin to be posted somewhere else. I'll be sad to go. This once-divided city reminds me of myself. My struggle for unification, for Einheit. Coming from a city still cut in half by racial hatred, I feel hopeful here in Berlin. A word on my shame. I don't condone it. I'm trying my best to get over it. The intersex movement aims to put an end to infant genital reconfiguration surgery. The first step in that struggle is to convince the world, and pediatric endocrinologists in particular, that hermaphroditic genitals are not diseased. One out of every 2,000 babies is born with ambiguous genitalia. In the United States, with a population of 275 million, that comes to 137,000 intersexuals alive today. But we hermaphrodites are people like everybody else. And I happen not to be a political person. I don't like groups. Though I'm a member of the Intersex Society of North America, I have never taken part in its demonstrations. I live my own life and nurse my own wounds. It's not the best way to live, but it's the way I am. The most famous hermaphrodite in history. Me? Felt good to write that, but I've got a long way to go. I'm closeted at work, revealing myself only to a few friends. At cocktail receptions, when I find myself standing next to the former ambassador, also a native of Detroit, we talk about the Tigers. Only a few people here in Berlin know my secret. I tell more people than I used to, but I'm not at all consistent. Some nights I tell people I've just met. In other cases, I keep silent forever. That goes especially for women I'm attracted to. When I meet someone I like and who seems to like me, I retreat. There are lots of nights out in Berlin when, emboldened by a good value Rioja, I forget my physical predicament and allow myself to hope. The tailored suit comes off, the Thomas Pink shirt too. My dates can't fail to be impressed by my physical condition. Under the armor of my double-breasted suits is another of gym-built muscle. But the final protection, my roomy, my discreet boxer shorts, these I do not remove, ever. Instead, I leave, making excuses. I leave and never call them again, just like a guy. And soon enough I'm at it again. I am trying once more, towing the line. I saw my bicyclist again this morning. This time I found out her name, Julie. Julie Kikuchi. Raised in Northern California, graduate of the Rhode Island School of Design, and currently in Berlin on a grant from the Künstlerhaus Bethanien. But more important right now, my date for Friday night. It's just a first date. It won't come to anything. No reason to mention my peculiarities, my wandering in the maze these many years, shut away from sight. And from love, too. The simultaneous fertilization had occurred in the early morning hours of March 24, 1923, in separate, vertical bedrooms, after a night out at the theater. My grandfather, not knowing he was soon to be fired, had splurged on 4 tickets to the Minotaur, playing at the Family. At first, Desdemona had refused to go. She disapproved of theater in general, especially vaudeville. But in the end, unable to resist the Hellenic theme, she had put on a new pair of stockings and a black dress and overcoat and made her way with the others down the sidewalk and into the terrifying Packard. When the curtain rose at the Family Theater, my relatives expected to get the whole story. How Minos, king of Crete, failed to sacrifice a white bull to Poseidon. How Poseidon, enraged, caused Minos' wife, Pasiphae, to be smitten with love for a bull. How the child of that union, Asterius, came out with a bull's head attached to a human body. And then Daedalus, the maze, etc. As soon as the footlights came on, however, the production's non-traditional emphasis became clear. Because now they pranced on stage. The chorus girls, dressed in silver halters, robed in see-through shifts, they danced, reciting strophes that didn't scan to the eerie piping of flutes. The Minotaur appeared, an actor wearing a papier-mâché bull's head. Lacking any sense of classical psychology, the actor played his half-human character as pure movie monster. He growled. Drums pounded. Chorus girls screamed and fled. The Minotaur pursued, and of course he caught them, each one, and devoured her bloodily, and dragged her pale, defenseless body deeper into the maze. And the curtain came down. In the 18th row, my grandmother gave her critical opinion. "It's like the paintings in the museum," she said. "Just an excuse to show people with no clothes." She insisted on leaving before Act Two. At home, getting ready for bed, the 4 theater-goers went about their nightly routines. Desdemona washed out her stockings, lit the vigil lamp in the hallway. Zizmo drank a glass of the papaya juice he touted as beneficial for the digestion. Lefty neatly hung up his suit, pinching each trouser crease, while Sormelina removed her makeup with cold cream and went to bed. The 4 of them, moving in their individual orbits, pretended that the play had had no effect on them. But now Jimmy Zizmo was turning off his bedroom light. Now he was climbing into his single bed to find it occupied. Sumalina, dreaming of chorus girls, had sleepwalked across the throw rug. Murmuring strophes, she climbed on top of her stand-in husband. "You see," Zizmo said in the dark, "no more bile. It's the castor oil." Upstairs, Desdemona might have heard something through the floor if she hadn't been pretending to be asleep. Against her will, the play had aroused her too. The Minotaur's savage muscular thighs, the suggestive sprawl of his victims. Ashamed of her excitement, she gave no outward sign. She switched off the lamp. She told her husband good night. She yawned, also theatrical, and turned her back while Lefty stole up from behind. Freeze the action. A momentous night, this, for all involved, including me. I want to record the positions. Lefty, dorsal, Lena, couchant, and the circumstances. Night's amnesty. And the direct cause. A play about a hybrid monster. Parents are supposed to pass down physical traits to their children, but it's my belief that all sorts of other things get passed down too, motifs, scenarios, even fates. Wouldn't I also sneak up on a girl pretending to be asleep? And wouldn't there also be a play involved and somebody dying on stage? Leaving these genealogical questions aside, I return to the biological facts. Like college girls sharing a dorm room, Desdemona and Lena were both synchronized in their menstrual cycles. That night was day 14. No thermometer verified this, but a few weeks later, the symptoms of nausea and hypersensitive noses did.
Whoever named it morning sickness was a man, Lena declared. He was just home in the morning to notice.
The nausea kept no schedule. It owned no watch. They were sick in the afternoon, in the middle of the night. Pregnancy was a boat in a storm and they couldn't get off, and so they lashed themselves to the masts of their beds and rode out the squall.
Everything they came in contact with, the bedsheets, the pillows, the air itself began to turn on them. Their husband's breath became intolerable. And when they weren't too sick to move, they were waving their arms, gesturing to the men to keep away.
Pregnancy humbled the husbands. After an initial rush of male pride, they quickly recognized the minor role that nature had assigned them in the drama of reproduction, and quietly withdrew into a baffled reserve, catalysts to an explosion they couldn't explain. While their wives grandly suffered in the bedrooms, Zizmo and Lefty retreated to the sala to listen to music, or drove to a coffee house in Greektown, where no one would be offended by their smell. They played backgammon and talked politics, and no one spoke about women, because in the coffee house, everyone was a bachelor, no matter how old he was or how many children he'd given a wife who preferred their company to his. The talk was always the same, of the Turks and their brutality, of Venizelos and his mistakes, of King Constantine and his return, and of the unavenged crime of Smyrna burned.
And does anybody care? No. It's like what Beranger said to Clemenceau. He who owns the oil owns the world. Oh, those damned Turks, murderers and rapists. They desecrated the Hagia Sophia, and now they destroyed Smyrna.
But here Zizmo spoke up. Stop bellyaching. The war was the Greeks' fault. Who invaded who? Asked Zizmo.
The Turks invaded in 1453.
The Greeks can't even run their own country. Why do they need another?
At this point, men stood up, chairs were knocked over.
Who the hell are you, Zizmo? Goddamn Pontian Turk sympathizer!
I sympathize with the truth, shouted Zizmo. There's no evidence the Turks started that fire. The Greeks did it, to blame it on the Turks!
Lefty stepped between the men, preventing a fight. After that, Zizmo kept his political opinions to himself. He sat morosely drinking coffee, reading an odd assortment of magazines or pamphlets speculating on space travel and ancient civilizations. He chewed his lemon peels and told Lefty to do so too. Together, they settled into the random camaraderie of men on the outskirts of a birth. Like all expectant fathers, their thoughts turned to money. My grandfather had never told Jimmy the reason for his dismissal from Ford, but Zizmo had a good idea why it might have happened. And so, a few weeks later, he made what restitution he could.
Just act like we're going for a drive.
Okay.
If we get stopped, don't say anything.
Okay.
This is a better job than the Rouge, believe me. $5 a day is nothing. And here, you can eat all the garlic you want.
They are in the Packard, passing the amusement grounds of Electric Park. It's foggy out and late, just past 3 a.m. To be honest, the amusement grounds should be closed at this hour, but for my own purposes, tonight, Electric Park is open all night, and the fog suddenly lifts. Also that my grandfather can look out the window and see a roller coaster streaking down the track. A moment of cheap symbolism only, and then I have to bow to the strict rules of realism, which is to say, they can't see a thing. Spring fog foams over the ramparts of the newly opened Belle Isle Bridge. The yellow globes of street lamps glow aureoled in the mist. Lot of traffic for this late. Lefty marvels.
Yes, says Zizmo. It's very popular at night.
The bridge lifts them gently above the river and sets them back down on the other side. Belle Isle, a paramecium-shaped island in the Detroit River, lies less than half a mile from the Canadian shore, By day, the park is full of picnickers and strollers. Fishermen lie in its muddy banks. Church groups hold tent meetings. Come dark, however, the island takes on an offshore atmosphere of relaxed morals. Lovers park in secluded lookouts. Cars roll over the bridge on shadowy missions. Zizmo drives through the gloom, past the octagonal gazebos and the monument of the Civil War hero, and into the woods where the Ottawa once held their summer camp. Fog wipes the windshield. Birch trees shed parchment beneath an ink-black sky. Missing from most cars in the 1920s, rear-view mirrors. "Steer," Zizmo keeps saying, and turns around to see if they're being followed. In this fashion, trading the wheel, they weave along Central Avenue and the Strand, circling the island three times until Zizmo is satisfied. At the northeastern end, he pulls the car over, facing Canada. "Why are we stopping?" "Wait and see." Zizmo turns the headlights on and off three times. He gets out of the car, so does Lefty. They stand in the darkness amid river sounds, waves lapping, freighters blowing foghorns. Then there's another sound, a distant hum. "You have an office?" my grandfather asks. "A warehouse?" "This is my office." Zizmo waves his hands through the air. He points to the Packard. "And that's my warehouse." The hum is getting louder now. Lefty squints through the fog. "I used to work for the railroad." Zizmo takes a dried apricot out of his pocket and eats it. "Out west in Utah, broke my back. Then I got smart." But the hum has almost reached them. Zizmo is opening the trunk, and now in the fog, an outboard appears, a sleek craft with two men aboard. They cut the engine as the boat glides into the reeds. Zizmo hands an envelope to one man. The other whisks the tarp off the boat's stern. In moonlight, neatly stacked, 12 wooden crates gleam. "Now I run a railroad of my own," says Zizmo. "Start unloading." The precise nature of Jimmy Zizmo's importing business was thus revealed. He didn't deal in dried apricots from Syria, halva from Turkey, and honey from Lebanon. He imported Hiram Walker's whiskey from Ontario, beer from Quebec, and rum from Barbados by way of the St. Lawrence River. A teetotaler himself, he made his living buying and selling liquor. "If these Americani are all drunks, what can I do?" he justified driving away minutes later.
"You should have told me," Lefty shouted in rage. "If we get caught, I won't get my citizenship. They'll send me back to Greece."
"What choice do you have? You have a better job? And don't forget, you and I, we have babies on the way."
So began my grandfather's life of crime. For the next 8 months, he worked in Zizmo's rum-running operation, observing its odd hours, getting up in the middle of the night and having dinner at dawn. He adopted the slang of the illegal trade, increasing his English vocabulary fourfold. He learned to call liquor hooch, bingo, squirrel dew, and monkey swill. He referred to drinking establishments as boozeries, doggeries, rum holes, and schooners. He learned the locations of blind pigs all over the city, the funeral parlors that filled bodies not with embalming fluid but with gin, the churches that offered something more than sacramental wine, and the barber shops whose barbicide jars contained blue ruin. Lefty grew familiar with the shoreline of the Detroit River. It screened inlets and secret landings. He could identify police outboards at a distance of a quarter mile. Rum running was a tricky business. The major bootlegging was controlled by the Purple Gang and the Mafia. In their beneficence, they allowed a certain amount of amateur smuggling to go on. The day trips to Canada, the fishing boats out for a midnight cruise. Women took the ferry to Windsor with gallon flasks under their dresses. As long as such smuggling didn't cut into the main business, the gangs allowed it. But Zizmo was far exceeding the limit. They went out 5 to 6 times a week. The Packard's trunk could fit 4 cases of liquor. Its commodious curtain backseat, 8 more. Zizmo respected neither rules nor territories.
As soon as they voted in prohibition, I went to the library and looked at a map, he said, explaining how he'd gotten into the business. There they were, Canada and Michigan, almost kissing. So I bought a ticket to Detroit. When I got here, I was broke. I went to see a marriage broker in Greektown. The reason I let Lena drive this car, she paid for it.
He smiled with satisfaction, but then followed his thoughts a little further and his face darkened.
I don't approve of women driving, mind you. Now they get to vote, he grumbled to himself. Remember that play we saw? All women are like that. Given the chance, they'd all fornicate with a bull.
Those are just stories, Jimmy, said Lefty. You can't take them literally.
Why not? Zizmo continued. Women aren't like us. They have carnal natures. The best thing to do with them is to shut them up in a maze.
What are you talking about?
Zizmo smiled. Pregnancy.
It was like a maze. Desdemona kept turning this way and that, left side, right side, trying to find a comfortable position. Without leaving her bed, she wandered the dark corridors of pregnancy, stumbling over the bones of women who had passed this way before her. For starters, her mother, Euphrosyne, whom she was suddenly beginning to resemble, her grandmothers, her great-aunts, and all the women before them, stretching back into prehistory, right back to Eve, on whose womb the curse had been laid. Desdemona came into a physical knowledge of these women, shared their pains and sighs, their fear and protectiveness, their outrage, their expectation. Like them, she put a hand to her belly, supporting the world. She felt omnipotent and proud, and then a muscle in her back spasmed. I give you now the entire pregnancy in time lapse. Desdemona, at 8 weeks, lies on her back, bed covers drawn up to her armpits. The light at the window flickers with the change of day and night. Her body jerks. She's on her side, her belly. The covers change shape. A wool blanket appears and disappears. Food trays fly to the bedside table, then jump away before returning. But throughout the mad dance of inanimate objects, the continuity of Desdemona's shifting body remains at center. Her breasts inflate, her nipples darken. At 14 weeks, her face begins to grow plump, so that for the first time I can recognize the Yaya of my childhood. At 20 weeks, a mysterious line starts drawing itself down from her navel. Her belly rises like Jiffy Pop. At 30 weeks, her skin thins and her hair gets thicker. Her complexion, pale with nausea at first, grows less so until there it is, a glow. The bigger she gets, the more stationary. She stops lying on her stomach, motionless. She swells toward the camera. The window's strobe effect continues. At 36 weeks, she cocoons herself in bed sheets. The sheets go up and down, revealing her face, exhausted, euphoric, resigned, impatient. Her eyes open. She cries out. Lena wrapped her legs in putties to prevent varicose veins. Worried that her breath was bad, she kept a tin of mints beside her bed. She weighed herself each morning, biting her lower lip. She enjoyed her new buxom figure, but fretted about the consequences. Oh, my breasts will never be the same. I know it. After this, just flaps, like in the National Geographic. Pregnancy made her feel too much like an animal. It was embarrassing to be so publicly colonized. Her face felt on fire during hormone surges. She perspired. Her makeup ran. The entire process was a holdover from more primitive stages of development. It linked her with the lower forms of life. She thought of queen bees spewing eggs. She thought of the collie next door digging its hole in the backyard last spring. The only escape was radio. She wore her earphones in bed, on the couch, in the bathtub. During the summer, she carried her Areola Junior outside and sat under the cherry tree. Filling her head with music, she escaped her body. On a third trimester October morning, a cab pulled up outside 3467 Hurlbut Street, and a tall, slender figure climbed out. He checked the address against a piece of paper, collected his things, umbrella and suitcase, and paid the driver. He took off his hat and stared into it as though reading instructions along the lining. Then he put the hat back on and walked up onto the porch. Desdemona and Lena both heard the knocking. They met at the front door. When they opened it, the man looked from belly to belly.
"I'm just in time," he said.
It was Dr. Philobosian, clear-eyed, clean-shaven, recovered from his grief.
"I saved your address."
They invited him in, and he told his story. He had indeed contracted the eye disease Favus on the Julia, but his medical license had saved him from being sent back to Greece. America needed physicians. Dr. Philobosian had stayed a month in the hospital at Ellis Island, after which, with sponsorship from the Armenian Relief Agency, he had been admitted into the country. For the last 11 months, he'd been living in New York on the Lower East Side,
grinding lenses for an optometrist.
Recently, he'd managed to retrieve some assets from Turkey and had come to the Midwest.
"I'm going to open a practice here. New York has too many doctors already."
He stayed for dinner. The women's delicate conditions didn't excuse them from domestic duties. On swollen legs, they carried out dishes of lamb and rice, okra and tomato sauce, Greek salad, rice pudding. Afterward, Desdemona brewed Greek coffee, serving it in demitasse cups with the brown foam, the lakia, on top. Dr. Philobosian remarked to the seated husbands,
100-1 odds. Are you sure it happened on the same night?"
"Yes," Sormelina replied, smoking at the table. "There must have been a full moon."
"It usually takes a woman 5 or 6 months to get pregnant," the doctor went on. "To have you two do it on the same night, 100-1 odds." 100-1.
Zizmo looked across the table at Sormelina, who looked away.
"Or 100-1 at least," assured the doctor.
"It's all the Minotaur's fault," Lefty joked. "Don't talk about that play," Desdemona scolded. "Why are you looking at me like that?" asked Lena.
"I can't look at you," asked her husband.
Sormelina let out an exasperated sigh and wiped her mouth with her napkin. There was a strained silence. Dr. Philobosian, pouring himself another glass of wine, rushed in.
"Birth is a fascinating subject. Take deformities, for instance. People used to think they were caused by maternal imagination. During the conjugal act, whatever the mother happened to look at or think about would affect the child. There's a story in Damascene about a woman who had the picture of John the Baptist over her bed, wearing the traditional hair shirt. In the throes of passion, the poor woman happened to glance up at this portrait. 9 months later, her baby was born furry as a bear." The doctor laughed, enjoying himself, sipping more wine.
"That can't happen, can it?" Desdemona, suddenly alarmed, wanted to know. But Dr. Philobosian was on a roll.
"There's another story about a woman who touched a toad while making love. Her baby came out with pop eyes and covered with warts."
"This is in a book you read?" Desdemona's voice was tight.
"Pares on Monsters and Marvels has most of this. The church got into it, too. In his embryological sacra, Kangiamila recommended intrauterine baptism. Suppose you were worried that you might be carrying a monstrous baby. Well, there was a cure for that. You simply filled a syringe with holy water and baptized the infant before it was born."
"Don't worry, Desdemona," Lefty said, seeing how anxious she looked. "Doctors don't think that anymore."
"Oh, of course not," said Dr. Philobosian. "All this nonsense comes from the Dark Ages. We know now that most birth deformities result from the consanguinity of the parents."
"From the what?" asked Desdemona.
"From families intermarrying."
Desdemona went white.
"Causes all kinds of problems, imbecility, hemophilia. Look at the Romulovs. Look at any royal family. Mutants, all of them."
"I don't remember what I was thinking that night," Desdemona said later while washing the dishes.
"I do," said Lena.
"Third one from the right with the red hair." I had my eyes closed. "Then don't worry." Desdemona turned on the water to cover their voices. "And what about the other thing? The consanguinity?" "Yes. How do you know if the baby has that?"
"You don't know until it's born."
Manna! Why do you think the church doesn't let brothers and sisters get married? Even first cousins have to get permission from a bishop. I thought it was because... And she trailed off, having no answer.
Don't worry, Lena said. These doctors exaggerate. If families marrying each other was so bad, we'd all have six arms and no legs.
But Desdemona did worry. She thought back to Vithinios, trying to remember how many children had been born with something wrong with them.
Malia Salakis had a daughter with a piece missing from the middle of her face. Her brother, Yorgos, had been 8 years old his whole life.
Were there any babies with hair shirts? Any frog babies? Desdemona recalled her mother telling stories about strange infants born in the village. They came every few generations, babies who were sick in some way. Desdemona couldn't remember how exactly. Her mother had been vague. Every so often these babies appeared, and they always met with tragic ends. They killed themselves. They ran off and became circus performers. They were seen years later in Bursa, begging or prostituting themselves. Lying alone in bed at night, with Lefty out working, Desdemona tried to recall the details of these stories, but it was too long ago, and now Ephrosyne Stefanides was dead, and there was no one to ask. She thought back to the night she'd gotten pregnant and trying to reconstruct events. She turned on her side. She made a pillow stand in for Lefty, pressing it against her back. She looked around the room. There were no pictures on the walls. She hadn't been touching any toads. What did I see? She asked herself. Only the wall. But she wasn't the only one tormented by anxieties, recklessly now, and with an official disclaimer as to the veracity of what I'm about to tell you, because of all the actors in my Midwestern Epidaurus, the one wearing the biggest mask is Jimmy Zizmo. I'll try to give you a glimpse into his emotions that last trimester. Was he excited about becoming a father? Did he bring home nutritive roots and brew homeopathic teas? No, he wasn't. He didn't. After Dr. Philobosian came to dinner that night, Jimmy Zizmo began to change. Maybe it was what the doctor had said regarding the synchronous pregnancies, 100-to-1 odds. Maybe it was this stray bit of information that was responsible for Zizmo's increasing moodiness, his suspicious glances at his pregnant wife. Maybe he was doubting the likelihood that a single act of intercourse in a 5-month dry spell would result in a successful pregnancy. Was Zizmo examining his young wife and feeling old? Tricked? In the late autumn of 1923, minotaurs haunted my family. To Desdemona, they came in the form of children who couldn't stop bleeding or who were covered with fur. Zizmo's monster was the well-known one with green eyes. It stared out of the river's darkness while he waited on shore for a shipment of liquor. It leapt up from the roadside to confront him through the Packard's windshield. It rolled over in bed when he got home before sunrise, a green-eyed monster lying next to his young, inscrutable wife. But then Zizmo would blink, and the monster would disappear. When the women were 8 months pregnant, the first snow fell. Lefty and Zizmo wore gloves and mufflers as they waited on the shore of Belle Isle. Nevertheless, despite his insulation, my grandfather was shivering. Twice in the last month they'd had close calls with the police. Sick with jealous suspicions, Zizmo had been erratic. Forgetting to schedule rendezvous, choosing drop-off points with insufficient preparation, worse, the Purple Gang was consolidating its hold on the city's rum-running. It was only a matter of time before they ran afoul of it. Meanwhile, back on Hurlbut, a spoon was swinging. Sormelina, legs bandaged, lay back in her boudoir as Desdemona performed the first of the many prognostications that would end with me. Tell me it's a girl. You don't want a girl. Girls are too much trouble. You have to worry about them going with the boys. You have to get a dowry and find a husband. They don't have dowries in America, Desdemona. The spoon began to move. If it's a boy, I'll kill you. A daughter you'll fight with. A daughter I can talk to. A son you will love. The spoon's arc increased. It's... What? Start saving money. Yes?
Lock the windows.
Is it really? Get ready to fight. You mean it's, yes, a girl, definitely. Oh, thank God.
And a walk-in closet being cleaned out, and the walls being painted white to serve as a nursery. Two identical cribs arrive from Hudson's. My grandmother sets them up in the nursery, then hangs a blanket between them, in case her child is a boy. Out in the hall, she stops before the vigil light to pray to the All-Holy.
Please, don't let my baby be this thing, a hemophiliac. Lefty and I didn't know what we were doing. Please, I swear, I will never have another baby. Just this one.
33 weeks. 34. In uterine swimming pools, babies perform half-gainers, flipping over head first. But Sormelina and Desdemona, so synchronized in their pregnancies, diverged at the end. On December 17th, while listening to a radio play, Sormelina removed her earphones and announced that she was having pains. 3 hours later, Dr. Philobosian delivered a girl, as Desdemona predicted. The baby weighed only 4 pounds, 3 ounces and had to be kept in an incubator for a week. See? Lena said to Desdemona, gazing at the baby through the glass. Dr. Phil was wrong. Look, her hair's black, not red. Jimmy Zizmo approached the incubator next. He removed his hat and bent very close to squint. And did he wince? Did the baby's pale complexion confirm his doubts or provide answers as to why a wife might complain of aches and pains or why she might be conveniently cured in order to prove his paternity? Whatever his doubts, the child was his. Sormelina's complexion had merely stolen the show. Genetics, a crapshoot entirely. All I know is this. Shortly after Zizmo saw his daughter, he came up with his final scheme. A week later, he told Lefty,
"Get ready. We have business tonight."
And now the mansions along the lake are lit with Christmas lights. The great snow-covered lawn of Rose Terrace, the Dodge Mansion, boasts a 40-foot Christmas tree trucked in from the Upper Peninsula. Elves race around the pine in miniature Dodge sedans. Santa is chauffeured by a reindeer in a cap. Rudolph hasn't been created yet, so the reindeer's nose is black. Outside the mansion's gates, a black and tan Packard passes by. The driver looks straight ahead. The passenger gazes out at the enormous house. Jimmy Zizmo is driving slowly, because of the chains on the tires. They've come out along East Jefferson, past Electric Park and the Belle Isle Bridge. They've continued through Detroit's east side, following Jefferson Avenue, and now we're here, my neck of the woods, Grosse Pointe. Here's the Starks' house, where Clementine Stark and I will practice kissing the summer before third grade. And there's the Baker and Inglis School for Girls, high on its hill over the lake. My grandfather is well aware that Zizmo hasn't come to Grosse Pointe to admire the big houses. Anxiously, he waits to see what Zizmo has in mind. Not far from Rose Terrace, the lakefront opens up, black, empty, and frozen solid. Near the bank, the ice piles up in chunks. Zizmo follows the shoreline until he comes to a gap in the road where boats launch in summer. He turns into it and stops. "We're going over the ice?" my grandfather says.
"Easiest way to Canada at the moment."
"Are you sure it will hold?" In response to my grandfather's question, Zizmo only opens his door to facilitate escape. Lefty follows suit. The Packard's front wheels drop onto ice. It feels as if the entire frozen lake shifts. A high-pitched noise follows as when teeth bear down on ice cubes. After a few seconds, this stops. The rear wheels drop. The ice settles. My grandfather, who hasn't prayed since he was in Bursa, has the impulse to give it another go. Lake St. Clair is controlled by the Purple Gang. It provides no trees to hide behind, no side roads to sneak down. He bites his thumb where the nail is missing. Without a moon, they see only what the insectile headlamps illuminate.
15 feet of granular, ice-blue surface crisscrossed by tire tracks. Vortices of snow whirl up in front of them. Zizmo wipes the fogged windshield with his shirt sleeve.
Keep a lookout for dark ice.
Why?
That means it's thin.
It's not long before the first patch appears. Where shoals rise, lapping water weakens the ice. Zizmo steers around it. Soon, however, another patch appears and he has to go in the other direction. Right, left, right. The Packard snakes along, following the tire tracks of other rum runners. Occasionally, an ice house blocks their path and they have to back up, return the way they came. Now to the right. Now the left. Now backward, now forward, moving into the darkness, over ice as smooth as marble. Zizmo leans over the wheel, squinting toward where the beams die out. My grandfather holds his door open, listening for the sound of the ice groaning. But now, over the engine noise, another noise starts up. Across town, on this very same night, my grandmother is having a nightmare. She's in a lifeboat aboard the Julia. Captain Cantulis kneels between her legs, removing her wedding corset. He unlaces it, pulls it open, while puffing on a clove cigarette. Desdemona, filled with embarrassment at her sudden nakedness, looks down at the object of the captain's fascination. A heavy ship's rope disappears inside her.
Heave-ho!
Captain Cantulis shouts, and Lefty appears, looking concerned. He takes the end of the rope and begins pulling, and then... pain. Dream pain. Real, but not real, just the neurons firing. Deep inside Desdemona, a water balloon explodes. Warmth gushes against her thighs as blood fills the lifeboat. Lefty gives a tug on the rope, then another. Blood spatters the captain's face, but he lowers his brim and weathers it. Desdemona cries out. The lifeboat rocks, and then there's a popping sound, and she feels a sick sensation, as if she's being torn in two. And there, on the end of the rope, is her child. A little knot of muscle. Bruise-colored. And she looks to find the arms, and cannot. And she looks to find the legs, and cannot. And then the tiny head lifts, and she looks into her baby's face, a single crescent of teeth, opening and closing. No eyes, no mouth, only teeth, flapping open and shut. Desdemona bolts awake. It's a moment before she realizes that her actual real-life bed is soaked through. Her water has broken. While out on the ice, the Packard's headlamps brighten with each acceleration as more juice flows from the battery. They're in the shipping lane now, equidistant from both shores. The sky, a great black bowl above them, pierced with celestial fires. They can't remember the way they came now, how many turns they took, where the bad ice is. The frozen terrain is scrawled with tire tracks leading in every possible direction. They pass the carcasses of old jalopies, front ends fallen through the ice, doors riddled with bullet holes. There are axles lying about and hubcaps and a few spare tires. In the darkness and whirling snow, my grandfather's eyes play tricks on him. Twice, he thinks he sees a phalanx of cars approaching. The cars toy with them, appearing now in front, now to the side, now behind, coming and going so quickly he can't be sure if he saw them at all. And there is another smell in the Packard now, above leather and whiskey, astringent metallic smell overpowering my grandfather's deodorant. Fear. It's right then that Zizmo, in a calm voice, says,
"Something I always wondered about. Why don't you ever tell anyone that Lena is your cousin?"
The question, coming out of the blue, takes my grandfather off guard. "You don't keep it a secret."
"No," says Zizmo. "I've never heard you mention it."
"Where we come from, everybody is a cousin," Lefty tries to joke. "Then how much farther do we have to go?"
"Other side of the shipping line. We still on the American side."
"How are you going to find them out here?"
"We'll find them. You want me to speed up?
Without waiting for a reply, Zizmo steps on the accelerator. That's okay, go slow. Something else I always wanted to know, Zizmo says, accelerating. Jimmy, be safe. Why did Lena have to leave the village to get married? You're going too fast. I don't have time to check the ice. Answer me.
Why did she leave? There was no one to marry. She wanted to come to America.
Is that what she wanted? He accelerates again. Jimmy, slow down. But Zizmo pushes the pedal to the floor and shouts, "Is it you?
What are you talking about?
Is it you?" Zizmo roars again, and now the engine is whining. The ice is whizzing by underneath the car. "Who is it?" he demands to know. "Tell me, who is it?"
But before my grandfather can come up with an answer, another memory comes careening across the ice. It is a Sunday night during my childhood, and my father's taking me to the movies, the Detroit Yacht Club. We ascend the red-carpeted stairs, passing silver sailing trophies and the oil portrait of the hydroplane racer Garwood. On the second floor, we enter the auditorium. Wooden folding chairs are set up before a movie screen. And now the lights have been switched off, and the clanking projector shoots out a beam of light, showing a million dust motes in the air. The only way my father could think of to instill in me a sense of my heritage was to take me to dubbed Italian versions of the ancient Greek myths. And so every week we saw Hercules slaying the Nemean lion or stealing the girdle of the Amazons. That's some girdle, eh, Callie? Or being thrown gratuitously into snake bits without textual support. But our favorite was the Minotaur. On the screen, an actor in a bad wig appears. "That's Theseus," Milton explains. "He's got this ball of string his girlfriend gave him, see, and he's using it to find his way back out of the maze." Now Theseus enters the labyrinth. His torch lights up stone walls made of cardboard. Bones and skulls litter his path. Blood stains darken the fake rock. Without taking my eyes from the screen, I hold out my hand. My father reaches into the pocket of his blazer to find a butterscotch candy. As he gives it to me, he whispers, "Here comes the Minotaur," and I shiver with fear and delight. Academic to me, then, the sad fate of the creature. Asterius, through no fault of his own, born a monster, the poisoned fruit of betrayal, a thing of shame, hidden away. I don't understand any of that at 8. I'm just rooting for Theseus. As my grandmother in 1923 prepares to meet the creature hidden in her womb. Holding her belly, she sits in the back seat of the taxi while Lena up front tells the driver to hurry. Desdemona breathes in and out like a runner pacing herself, and Lena says, "I'm not even mad at you for waking me up. I was going to the hospital in the morning anyway. They're letting me take the baby home." But Desdemona isn't listening. She opens her prepacked suitcase, feeling among nightgown and slippers for her worry beads. Amber like congealed honey, cracked by heat, they've gotten her through massacres, a refugee march, and a burning city. And she clicks them as the taxi rattles over the dark streets, trying to outrace her contractions. As Zizmo races the Packard over the ice, the speedometer needle rises, the engine thunders, tire chains rooster tail snow, the Packard hurtles into the darkness, skidding on patches, fishtailing. "Did you two have it all planned?" he shouts. "Have Lena marry an American citizen so she could sponsor you?" "What are you talking about?" my grandfather tries to reason. "When you and Lena got married, I didn't even know I was coming to America. Please slow down."
"Was that the plan? Find a husband and then move into his house?"
The never-failing conceit of Minotaur movies. The monster always approaches from the direction you least expect. Likewise, out on Lake St. Clair, my grandfather has been looking out for the Purple Gang, when in reality, the monster is right next to him at the wheel of the car. In the wind from the open door, Zizmo's frizzy hair streams back like a mane. His head is lowered, his nostrils flared, his eyes shine with fury.
"Who is it?"
"Jimmy, turn around. The ice, you're not looking at the ice."
"I won't stop unless you tell me."
"There's nothing to tell. Lena's a good girl, a good wife to you, I swear."
But the Packard hurtles on. My grandfather flattens himself against his seat.
"What about the baby, Jimmy? Think about your daughter."
"Who's
says it's mine. Of course it's yours. I never should have married that girl.
Lefty doesn't have time to argue the point. Without answering any more questions, he rolls out the open door free of the car. The wind hits him like a solid force, knocking him back against the rear fender. He watches as his muffler, in slow motion, winds itself around the Packard's back wheel. He feels it tighten like a noose, but then the scarf comes loose from his neck, and time speeds up again as Lefty is thrown clear of the auto. He covers his face as he hits the ice, skidding a great distance. When he looks up again, he sees the Packard still going.